So I'm like, I got it.
Welcome back. Good morning, everyone. So last time we left off, we were talking about networking. Today we're continuing that discussion, looking at some of the really essential, challenging problems in building, essentially building the internet. Anything before we get started? Okay, cool. So last time, we were discussing how we don't own all of the infrastructure for the internet. And so even if we try to communicate with some remote device, it's possible that our message gets lost. And that's because the network is best effort. That makes it much easier to scale, but means that we have a challenge for writing correct networking code, because we expect that when we write programs and we send something, it's actually going to be received. We don't want to handle the cases where it gets lost, and so we need a lower layer protocol to help us with this. Our first challenge was, what if the message gets lost? And we said, well, okay, we can address that by having the acknowledgement. Right? We'll have the recipient tell us, yes, I got your message. So that was our first mechanism. But then again, the question then was like, wait a minute, if the message can get lost, it sure seems like the acknowledgement can get lost as well, which is true. And so whether the message is lost or the acknowledgement is lost, we added another mechanism called a timeout, where machine A will wait for a while, see if it gets the acknowledgement. If it doesn't, it tries again. And these are sort of the two core primitives we use to handle the fact that messages can be lost in the network. But this kind of raised another question, right? Because we look at this and now we're sending the same message twice. And it's possible that both of those are received, but maybe the first acknowledgement is lost. And that can lead to some confusion at the receiver side, because now it potentially gets the same message twice. Did the sender mean to send it twice? Maybe. Or not. And so we're going to have to deal with that. I got to stop walking over there. OK. There's another issue, though, which is, so far we've been drawing the picture sort of like this, that one message is sent, we get the response, the acknowledgement is sent back. But again, the network is best effort, and so it's possible that things not only get lost, but they could also just be delayed. The internet is a complicated series of connected routers. There's multiple paths that a packet, a message could take from sender to receiver. It's possible that one of those paths end up being delayed, and actually a message that was sent later ends up received earlier. And so what we can see is a case like this, where machine A sends this message here. And it does arrive at machine B, just delayed. But what does A interpret that as? Right? A interprets that as something was lost, like we saw before. And so we'll have a timeout. But in the meantime, the message actually did get through, and B received it and sent back the acknowledgement, just like we said it should. But we have to sort of deal with this this challenge, because now machine A isn't really sure what happened again. So what do we expect to happen in this case? What's A going to do? Yeah.
Well, the timeout will probably send the message again.
Yeah, exactly. If we get the timeout, we expect that A will retransmit. Just like it's supposed to, right? Because maybe it got lost, and the acknowledgement's never coming. It doesn't know. So what's going to happen in this case? Well, one thing that can happen is this message is received. At some time later, we get the acknowledgement like we expected. So A is happy, right? However, B received the message again, and according to sort of its policy and what it's supposed to do is it's supposed to send back the ACK, the got it message. Right? And so then when that eventually is received over here, we'll get sort of an additional acknowledgement. So that's one challenge here. And so B doesn't have any way of knowing that it doesn't actually need to send this second acknowledgement. Because it's possible that the first acknowledgement was actually lost, and so the timeout was completely justified. A resent, and then B needs to send back the acknowledgement because otherwise A may never know, and then A is going to timeout again and retransmit again. And so we can end up with these cases where, because each side doesn't quite know what's going on, we have to be able to handle these types of issues in the network. Any questions on this flow? Yeah?
Are the messages that are being transmitted, are these packets? Or is it at a different level?
So we're looking at the transport layer, so we would often call these segments. A lot of times when we talk about networks, we often will just use the term packet to sort of mean any data message sent on the network.
I'd say when I taught networking last semester, I was like, gung-ho into, I'm going to use the word segment to refer to the transport layer stuff. All my sources mixed up the terms all the time.
Yeah.
This might be answered later, but is it really an issue to send two acknowledgments? Like, is that a problem for machine A, or is it just kind of say, okay, that was just two of them, but that means we know that the message was sent? Is that like...
Okay, so we can see this flow here, and, you know, kind of look at this and say, well, what's, you know, is there really an issue here, right? We get two acknowledgments. That seems fine, right? Like, you know, someone says like, yeah, I heard you. Yeah, I heard you. Okay, fine. Maybe a little bit annoying, but no big deal. That's true. However, what else might happen? So if A says, okay, the meeting's at noon, what else might you want to know about this meeting? Where it is, right? Okay, so we know there's a meeting, we know the time, but if we're gonna effectively meet, we have to be in the same place. So A is like, okay, I told you the event and the time. You said you got it, great. Now let me tell you the location. Make sense, right? Okay, but the network drops that packet. Bummer. A receives an acknowledgement. Got it. So what happens? A shows up to the meeting room at noon. No one's there. So that's the challenge with sort of these potential extra acknowledgements, is that it's sort of this blanket, I got it. What's it? It. And so if we had sent another message and then gotten the acknowledgement, but that message was actually never received, A doesn't know the difference. So that's one challenge here. Okay. And so these sort of delays can cause these sort of interactions. The acknowledgement can be delayed as well as the message. And so here, kind of the same type of issue happens. B actually does acknowledge on time, But the acknowledgement is received in time, so the A still times out, retransmits, and then B acknowledges that again, so we get the double ACK for the same message. And this can lead to these types of challenges. We'll get to how we can address this in a second, but are there other questions on this ordering of messages and acknowledgments? Okay, another challenge that's ends up being related is that we can't necessarily, well, we just can't. We can't send arbitrarily long messages. The hardware along the way, the routers in the network, generally have some fixed limit on how big any individual packet can be. And this is corresponds to sort of the just the physical memory hardware limitations of the hardware. It also makes things, it makes designing these hardware a little bit simpler if you don't have to accommodate sort of an arbitrarily large message. Well, what does that mean for our devices? Is that if we do want to send something that's large, like say a video, we can't just send it as one large message, we have to break it up. So using our example here, say there was some limit on the size of message, that meant we couldn't send our full the meetings at noon, we have to send the meeting. Okay, we send that, got it, and then we send is at noon, and that gets acknowledged. Okay, so not conceptually that difficult, right? We just break our larger thing into to smaller pieces and then send those piece by piece. Now this works, right? If all these messages are reliable, we get the correct message received at B. But like we saw before, things can go wrong. So here an example of the acknowledgement from B gets lost, A times out, like we saw, because it never hears back. It's like, I don't know what happened, but I'm going to try again. So it has to retry that initial message. That gets through as well. B does what it's supposed to, confirms receipt with the acknowledgement. Right? A is like, okay, great. I'll continue. So I told you that there's a meeting. Now I can tell you that it's at noon. B receives that and acknowledges that. So what's the issue here?
Machine B is going to reconstruct the meeting.
Yeah, exactly. So what happened on from B's point of view is that it got three messages. It doesn't know that the reason it got three messages is because the acknowledgement was lost. It just sees three messages, and so it reconstructs the meeting. The meeting is at noon, which in this case is sort of understandable, although as a programmer, you're going to be very confused why you sent one thing and the other side got something similar but different. Right, that it, essentially this sort of this extra the meeting just sort of got invented out of nowhere, which is not great. So we have this kind of host of problems. What's going wrong here? What are we missing? Yeah. Exactly, right? Intuitively, we're missing some sort of metadata to identify these segments as either the same or different, right? B has no idea if this second receiving of the meeting is actually a second different message, it just happens to have the same content, or if it's a retransmission of something earlier. And so that's our next technique that we're going to use, is we need to be able to identify identify segments with something, with a number, right? To differentiate that they're actually different segments and not just duplicates of an earlier one. And so this is generally, we call this a sequence number, so we can identify that this is part one, right? And then the second thing is something else, it's part two. Okay. And so this, so in, of course, the case where things work, we get the expected message. But also in the case where we lost the acknowledgement, what happens? Well, B receives the meeting twice, but now it knows that that was the same message, just a second copy. And so it can just ignore the second copy. A had to retransmit because A didn't know whether it got through or not. But B knows now that it can tell, and so it can ignore that. We still get the acknowledgement. We go on to the second part. B knows that that's, okay, that's not a duplicate. That's actually something different, and then we actually do reconstruct the correct message. So this is better. However, remember we saw the issue before where extra acknowledgments can cause trouble, right? And so we actually have the same issue here as well. So what happens if, instead of being lost, this message, this acknowledgment here, instead of being lost, was just delayed? So it actually was received, but it just came in later. Well, remember, we said, okay, well, that's going to look like success to A, so A is going to move on and tell you when the meeting is. But now the second acknowledgement will come and actually acknowledge that earlier. So let's look, this is a little bit cleaner picture here, right? So same setup. Part one is retransmitted twice. Why? Because we had a timeout. B got the first one and sent back the acknowledgement. This time it's not lost, it's just delayed. And so it actually was received after the retransmission, right? So we have the retransmission here, the delayed ACK here. To A, that looks like success. So A's like, okay, that's fine. I can go ahead and send part two. But we get unlucky, and that's lost. But the acknowledgement for the earlier retransmission that B had to send, remember, because B doesn't know why A retransmitted. It doesn't know if the ACK was delayed or if it was lost, so B has to send this second acknowledgement, but then that receives to A, like, okay, great, part two, right? And so sequence numbers on just the sender side are not enough. We also need to include them with the acknowledgement side so we can actually say what we received. And so this is just, we're just extending this instead of saying got it, right? Just a general, I acknowledge. Instead we can say, okay, we got part one. And so now even when we get this second repeated acknowledgement for part one here, A doesn't go, oh look, part two got through. A looks at that and says, oh, that was just an extra acknowledgement from four. I actually do need to retransmit part two because I never got an acknowledgement for that, right? Until finally here, then we know part two got through. So these sequence numbers are our third technique. So we have what? We have acknowledgments, right? That's really, really important. Our second technique was timeouts. And our third technique are sequence numbers. And sequence numbers allow us to identify the messages we're sending, and then, but then also identify the acknowledgments and exactly what's being acknowledged. Questions? All right, we're cool with this. Good. All right, question for you. How many sequence numbers do we need? So to implement this correctly, how many different values of sequence numbers do we actually need? Yeah.
As many messages.
Okay, as many messages, so potentially kind of an infinite or very large number. Yeah?
I think eventually you could kind of move around, because okay. Like the 1 millionth message probably is not going to get confused with the second message.
Okay, so maybe we don't need something really, really large, a million should cover it, right? With the intuition that like, eventually, that first message, by the time we get to a million, is so far in the past that we don't need to worry. We're not going to be confused, right? So we can go back and use sequence number one again. So I think both of these are, you know, intuition is right. We could probably get away with like 999,999 for the same kind of argument. And we could probably keep going. And sort of the intuition is, well, we need as many sequence numbers as we have outstanding messages. And so in the pictures we've seen so far, we really just have one, right? A doesn't go on to part two until it knows that part one was received. And so that's why, so then it had to differentiate part one and part two. But at this point, once it knows that part two has been successfully received, it can send something else and just call it part one. And that will actually work. And so we just need as many sequence numbers as we have potential messages in sort of in flight at once. And so a really simple protocol just needs to tell you, is it the previous message or is it a new message? And just keep flipping back and forth. Now, real networks don't do that, as we'll see in a second. And we actually do want more sequence numbers. Okay, fourth issue for what can happen in a network is now the message is not lost. It's not necessarily delayed either. It does make it to the destination, but not intact. So it's corrupted in some way. Now we say corrupted, we're generally meaning that some bit in whatever the message is got flipped, right? We sent a zero, but we received a one. And this can happen. The message is traversing sort of many hops, router to router. If one of those routers sort of decodes the incoming packet slightly wrong and mistakes a zero for a one or vice versa, now what? So again, we kind of have this challenge where one side sends something, but what the other side receives is not the same, which is definitely concerning. So an example of this, right, is imagine if we're just sending a string and we get sort of this one bit flip here where that lower bit, right, goes to a zero. You know, suddenly your message is actually quite, in this case, semantically different. So we'd like to avoid this if we can. And it's definitely, it's not really up to us to make it so that the message is completely reliable, just like we saw. We can't avoid losses or delays. But what we can do is sort of protect against this. And so the intuition is we send not just the message, but we also send a checksum. Something that sort of computes over the message we sent that should match what we originally intended to send. So we have some function, right, that we take over our, the message we actually want to send, which gives us another value. And then we just send that as well. So we send the original message plus this new value, this checksum. And so, yeah, so it's going to cost us a little bit of overhead, right? We're sending additional data that's not our actual message, but might be worth it so we don't get confused. And then what happens on the receiver side is to basically reverse the process. It takes the data it actually did receive, it knows the same algorithm, computes the checksum that of the data it received, and then checks, does that match the checksum field it actually received? Now, if not, that indicates that something went wrong. And so what we typically, what we'll do generally is we just pretend like the message was never actually received in the first place. We typically will call this, we drop the message. Say, okay, I got something, but I don't think it's right, so I'm just going to ignore it and continue on as though I had never received anything. Now, we can have different checksum algorithms. So like a simple one is we just add up all the numbers and then take the lower eight bits, or we do, you know, rollover while we're doing the addition. We could count the number of one bits. There's various sort of mechanisms we can use for checksum, which have different trade-offs in how many bit flips they can detect. Because a simple checksum, if you get enough corruption, actually looks like it was okay, again, to something that can actually detect any number of changes. But for now, we can just say, okay, we have some algorithm that both sides can compute to check if anything, or at least if one bit flips in transit. Okay, any questions on this checksum idea? Yeah?
What if the checksum gets corrupted? How would that affect?
Yeah, what if the checksum is corrupted? Well, so the receiver is still going to compute the checksum on the original data. And if the original data didn't change, the checksum calculation is going to be correct. However, when it compares against the checksum it received, it won't match. And so we'll still hit the same case. We'll still drop the message. It's a little unfortunate because it turns out that the data were actually fine. It was just the checksum that was wrong. But we don't know that. Right, the receiver can't tell the difference, and so we're just going to have we're going to treat that like any other bit in the actual message field. The flip, yeah.
Just out of curiosity, is there like a perfect checksum that can detect like any corruption?
Is there a perfect checksum that can detect any corruption? Yes, and we will discuss that when we get to security. However, I will say now that the checksums we actually use in the networking protocols are not perfect like that. Again, a lot of this is based on the assumption that the network is generally speaking going to work more often than not. Okay. All right. So one issue with the design that we've sort of built up so far is that it's very slow. And what's been happening is we've basically been saying, okay, we're going to send one message, and then we're going to sit here and wait until we get a response. If we don't get a response, we'll retry that message until we do. And then once we say, okay, yes, we got the acknowledgement, great, let's move on, we do that again. Well, that means we're going to spend a lot of time waiting, right? Send a little bit, wait. Send a little bit, wait. And if our network is generally functional, that's not great. And so what real networks actually do is something more like this. They're actually going to have a window, and they're going to be willing to send many messages, however many messages are in the window at one time. And so they're in flight at the same time. In this case, we have a transmission window of size 4, just as an example. So we'll actually send 4 different parts at once. And the assumption is that, again, likely the network will succeed And so we'll get those messages through. But rather than having to wait for this to go and then all the way down to here for the acknowledgement, before we send the next message and then wait for that, which is going to take, you know, it's going to be way down below the slide. If everything goes according to plan, we actually have completed all four of these in sort of much less time. So we actually pipeline these messages in practice. And then the question then is, well, how many? Because the more you put in this window, that's going to increase the performance. You're doing more work sort of per unit time, right? So per this unit of time here, or I mean, we can sort of say like this whole window here. So basically for one, for the amount of time it takes to go from here all the way to the recipient and back, we're now doing sort of four units of work. If we made that, if we set five or six, we'd do even more. That's great. And so our devices should just be sending more and more and more, right? Well, how much? Just keep going? That's probably okay if you're the only one who does that. If for some reason you're the only device that just keeps sending more, if it's got more data to send, it just sends it. But if we all do that, we're going to overwhelm the network. And so we're not going to get into it in this class, but we need another mechanism that allows us to decide how big should this window be so that we can balance performance with not overloading the network when all of us are trying to send stuff at the same time. And so here you can also see that we need additional sequence numbers, and this will also say like act one, act two, act three, act four. When we are allowed to have more in-flight messages. Okay. So what we've been talking about so far is the reliability mechanism at the transport layer. There's two main transport layer protocols that we use in practice. TCP, or Transmission Control Protocol, that's the one that implements what we've seen so far. This idea of connections, of having a stream, of having this reliable stream. On the other hand, UDP is another option. It's simpler because it provides a lot less to our programs, but it's unreliable. And so it's designed to send a message. If it gets through, great. If it doesn't, well, bummer. It's kind of up to the application to deal with that. Whereas TCP is designed to be reliable. Also, TCP is a stream. So we've been talking about these parts. And so we have that socket abstraction where we can put data into the socket, we can send data, and we get this abstraction that we have this continuous stream of data being received on the other end. UDP is a message-based protocol. So sort of each transmission is a distinct message. And so if we, from our application with TCP, call sort of two writes with A and B, it's really the same as if we had just sent that together, or called write once with both. It's just that we added it to the stream in a different way. However, if we do that with UDP, because these are discrete messages, this is one, this is going to be one message, this is going to be another, it's not the same as if we had sent those together, because then we would have one message instead of two with A and B. So the high-level takeaway is that TCP is what provides the reliability. And so generally, when we think of connections between devices and networking sockets, we're really thinking of TCP. UDP, though, provides us a little bit of a simpler abstraction that maybe we can use in certain cases, where maybe we don't need reliability. Maybe it's okay if a few messages get lost. Or maybe we want the flexibility to be able to design our own protocol. UDP kind of provides that lower layer, or a little bit lower level abstraction, so we can do that. Any questions on TCP, UDP? what would we use UDP for? So we actually use it for a protocol we're going to talk about called DNS. We can use it for things like video streaming, because if you think about video, it's really a sequences of images, right? If you lose one frame in your video, like that might be okay. Right? Are you really gonna notice that? So that's sometimes it gets used from there. Often like embedded Internet of Things, low power devices like UDP, because it doesn't have a lot of extra overhead. And if you lose one sensor reading, maybe that's okay. And we can also use it as sort of a substrate to build other things. So if we want to experiment, we can use UDP to kind of implement our own reliable protocol that's not the same as what the operating system provides. So those are some examples of when UDP is useful. Okay. All right, so remember, we've got these layers, and this is how we can build large-scale networks, is by segmenting things into different functionality. We've been talking about this issue of reliability. When we think about some of the other issues, though, in actually building this layering stack, one crucial challenge is naming. So we've been sort of just talking about A and B to keep things simple, but we haven't really talked about what is machine A and what is machine B, and how did we agree that machine A was called machine A and machine B was called machine B? So when we sent something to B, how did anything know where to go? Like, imagine if I took an envelope and just wrote B on it and tried to put it in the mailbox. I mean, the post office is good at decoding addresses, don't get me wrong, but they're not going to be able to figure out what I mean by B, right? We need something more descriptive. That's why we have addresses and zip codes. So that's a question. The other thing is, when we actually write programs that use the network, we're not really just trying to have machine A talk to machine B. What we really want is something like a browser or an app on the client machine, in this case machine A, wants to talk to something specific, like a web server running on machine B. Machine B might be running multiple things. Maybe it also has, say, SSH. How does machine B know whether or not this message is supposed to go here or supposed to go here? And similarly, if we're trying to send data, well, like we saw with acknowledgments, even if we're just acknowledging the data, we want to have a response. How does that get back to A? So these are all really core problems. And what to address this is we need to have identifiers, and we're going to have multiple different types of identifiers to solve these different types of problems. Now, we often have sort of two versions of identifiers, a logical and a lower level location, or sort of specific to a layer. Identifier, in some sense, you can think of these a little bit like the left column is a little bit more human friendly, and the right column is a little bit more machine friendly. So for example, when we're programming, right, we use variable names because that has semantic useful meaning to us. Your processor does not care. In fact, your processor does not want to know that you called that variable counter. It is only interested in the memory address. Similarly, with networks, it's easier for us to think of virginia.edu, not an IP address, which is a series of numbers. However, the routers in the network would much prefer to know the series of numbers, because that's how it's going to decide how that message should get from one machine to the intended destination. Okay, so specifically, when we think about this set of identifiers, names, and addresses, these are, specifically when we think about this set of identifiers. I'll get it right. Okay. This set of identifiers, the ones that are start with the IP, V4 and V6, these are operating at the network layer. So the network layer is responsible for this connection across the global internet. It's what knows and has protocols for how we get from the machine sitting in this room to Google servers, or another university servers, or wherever else on the internet. This is done with the very boldly named protocol, the Internet Protocol. Man, if you ever have the opportunity in your career to call something like the Internet Protocol that all 5.5 billion computer users are going to use, that's astounding. But in any case, that's what we use. We have two versions, 4 and 6. Now, they didn't just pick those numbers. There were some other versions, but they sort of weren't really meant to be widely used. And this is what allows us to do that sort of full connection. And technically, this is kind of the layer we think of as packets. But again, packets, often the term often gets used everywhere. Now, to identify the source and destination, we need an address. We conveniently call that address an IP address because it's operating as part of the IP protocol. For version 4, one of the major differences between version 4 and version 6 is the size of the addresses. Version 4 uses 32-bit numbers as the address. Now, rather than sort of write out like a hex value, like we've done many times in this class, IP addresses are generally written in this notation where each byte is written as a decimal number with a dot between it. A little bit easier for us mere humans to write down and remember. But really, it's really just a 32-bit number like any other 32-bit number. Right, that you could, you know, write down in a full decimal number. Although this is a little bit more difficult because what we really want is we want hex, because we want to be able to keep the bytes separate. But we don't often, again, outside of this class, right? We don't often work in base 16. We generally use base 10, and so IP address format. Okay. Now these addresses are assigned to different devices on the internet. So here at UVA, we have a block that we use as part of our network. Companies have different ranges, can have sort of different size, different numbers of addresses. And this is how they're identified on the network. And so when somebody wants to send something to our network here, they're going to use an address in this range. Any questions on IP addresses? Yeah.
I mean, it seems like that's not like that many IP addresses. Like if UVA, just UVA, gets like a whole block of IP addresses, it seems like. Like, are there any like duplicates?
Yeah. So 32 bits, right? Not necessarily a huge number in the scheme of things when you think about the number of internet users. And so we'll talk about that. And that's actually one of the main drivers for IPv6, which is, again, still a protocol designed to connect any two devices sort of on the global internet, except now we have much bigger addresses, right, to solve this exact problem, which is that, like, is 32 bits really enough? 128 bits is a staggeringly large address space. And it does mean we need a slightly different format, right? Because the numbers are just a lot longer. And so addresses will look like this. So they actually are written in hex. Every 2 bytes is separated by a colon. And then if you have a long run of zeros, you can omit those with two Two columns. But you only do that once. So you can have an IPv6 address. Rather than having to write out 0000000000, you can just put two colons, but only in one spot in the address. Now, because we have so many more addresses, we can be much more flexible in giving these out. And so if you have a home internet service and it has IPv6 support, which a lot do nowadays, likely your internet service provider has actually given you 2 to the 64 addresses on the internet. So way more than the entire IPv4 address space for just your house. Right, that's exponential growth for you. Okay. So how do we actually use these addresses? Well, these are sort of our way to identify endpoints, but also to decide how to get to the remote device. And so we're just kind of zooming in here as like one snapshot. But remember, a network is really this connection of routers between networks. And so each individual router is basically making decisions. It's saying, if I get some message, some packet that's arrived to me, I have to decide, do I route it here? Do I route it there or there? In this case, we have three sort of next networks it can choose. And so each router is going to be configured to basically say, all right, if the destination matches here, then send to this network. And so this packet will come in and it will forward it over to network one. Now, if instead it's destined for something in this range, we'll send to network two, all right, and go this way. Does that make sense? Questions on this structure? Yeah.
So how much do like home routers participate in networking like other people's traffic?
How much do home routers participate in networking other people's traffic? Depends on what you mean by other people. So I think, generally speaking, not at all. It's really just a conduit for your house, because your upstream provider is only going to send you things that are destined for your devices. In practice.
So the router in this example is like from an upstream provider.
This general concept works no matter what. You could implement this, maybe not with these exact IP addresses, but you could implement something like this in your house if you want. And certainly in UVA, we've got many buildings, many different networks, an organization like UVA is definitely running something like this. But with kind of, you know, decision making on this scale of addresses, yeah, this is somewhere in like the core of the internet, like switching between continents kind of idea, probably. But the principles are the same, right? Whether you're deciding where to send something on your home network or, you know, your Google connecting San Francisco and Tokyo. The other thing that falls out of this, though, is these sort of groups that we're looking at addresses in, right? These addresses are similar, right? In this case, they actually, like, this byte matches, this byte matches, this byte matches. It's only this last byte here that's actually different. Yet, we send it all to the same location. And so the implication of that is that IP addresses are geographically distributed. We don't want to just have any address be anywhere, because that would mean that we would essentially have to have a separate rule for like every possible destination. Because address starting with, you know, this address, 4.0.0, might go to one network, and then the next 4.0.1 might go to some other network, and that would be terrible. So we group these addresses geographically. That's why organizations are given a range in the same, sort of the same kind of similar numbers, because, well, everything has to get to Virginia. And so for most of the internet, it's just about getting kind of closer and closer and closer. It's only the last bit where we really have to differentiate, okay, which building, let's say. Okay, any other questions on the network or IP and addresses? So that's one type of name, right? The IP address. When we talked about the transport layer a little bit ago, we were talking about reliability. The transport layer actually has two responsibilities. The other one here that we haven't talked about is reaching the correct program. And I kind of mentioned this, that we often, well, pretty much always, right, are running multiple programs which want to have network connectivity. And so if we can only identify a machine by a singular address, that's not enough. We don't really want to send machine to machine, although that's what we've been talking about. As programmers, we want to send program to program. I want to be able to write a client that runs on my device that communicates with a specific program running on another machine. And so IP addresses are not enough. We need another identifier, and we call that a port number. So just like we can have multiple recipients at an address or multiple PO boxes at a specific physical address, we can have multiple programs running identified by separate port numbers on a machine. And so these are actually part of the transport layer. So when we send a UDP message or a TCP, or we create a TCP connection, we are going to use a specific port number on either end. And then we typically assign a lot of port numbers. Some of the lower port numbers have specific uses, like we know 80 is used for HTTP and SSH is 22. That's typically on sort of the server end, because we need to know, like the client needs to know, like, oh, this is an SSH connection. I need to connect to the SSH server, not just anything. A lot of port numbers are just allocated randomly. Because if I'm a client, I don't actually care what my port number is, I just need one. And so combining port numbers and IP addresses, we can identify a specific connection. And so when two programs are connected in like a TCP connection, we can identify that by the source address and destination IP address. That's the machine. And then we need the source port and the destination port, the remote port, for the particular program. And with those four values, now we can uniquely identify a TCP connection. And just a note, if you do want to specify a specific port number, the bind call handles that. All right. So we've got IP addresses for the network layer, machine to machine, ports identify processes running on there. Now we only have 16 bits for port numbers, but ports don't need to be unique across multiple machines, right? It just needs to be unique on one machine. And so 16 bits has seemingly been fine. Like we haven't changed that since then, since it was decided. Okay. So we talked about sort of these identifiers and these identifiers. What about over here? So these numbers are great and all. Routers really like them. Not so great for us, right? Imagine we had to remember this, like something like this. Maybe if we take this 36 and make it a 37, and that's how you get to Canvas. You just had to memorize that number. You know, that would be kind of annoying. So what we want are more human-readable names, something like this or this, that we can actually remember much more easily. So humans want the string, computers want the number, but we need some way to connect, to map between those. And this is one of the most important pieces of internet infrastructure that allows us to do this, called DNS. for the domain name system. Now, sort of a little bit hidden from us, but what's happening kind of in the background is that your device, when you go to something like virginia.edu, is contacting a helping DNS server. Generally, this is provided by your internet service provider. So like Comcast would provide this, or UVA has these. And you say, I want to get to virginia.edu, but your machine needs to know that IP address, because it needs that to actually be able to send to the correct server. And so it's going to ask your ISP's DNS server, what is the IP address for this domain? So this is going to be the IP address. Now, your ISP's DNS server isn't necessarily a vault of global knowledge that knows everything at every time. And this could be changing. Maybe Virginia UVA needs to move the server, the website, to another server for some reason. And so we don't actually have this local DNS server know everything. We have a sort of global network of other DNS servers which store bits and pieces of all of this information. So if we know nothing, we know nothing. So we have to go to the root DNS server. This is where we start. Now, the root DNS server doesn't know the answer either, because it doesn't also want to store everything for every website on the entire internet. But it says, oh, you want a .edu? Oh, okay. Yeah. I don't know, but I know a server that handles .edu. You should go talk to that one. And so this local DNS server is going to go ahead and do exactly that. It's going to talk to the EDU DNS server. And then that one's going to say, oh, you want virginia.edu? Well, I don't know this whole thing, but I know where Virginia keeps its domain name. So you should go talk to that server. Oh, you want www.cs.virginia? I don't know that, but I know where the CS department keeps its DNS server, so you should go talk to that one. And then finally, hopefully, right, if everything is configured correctly, the cs.virginia.edu domain name server will go, oh, yeah, sure, I know that. here's your address. And then that can get sent back. Finally, once we get that information, the final IP address, we can send that back, and now your machine knows that the particular IP address for the domain it was looking for. Great. Any questions on that lookup process? So without this, right, without this system, think what happens. Effectively, without this, you lose internet connectivity. Even if you're connected to the network, even if you can send messages, even if all the routing is working perfectly, if we can't identify things by a name, all of our services break. Like, you can't type in something to your browser. The apps, which are programmed to use these human-readable strings, just stop working. And so a lot of times, when it looks like the network is broken, it's really just that the DNS, something's wrong with this system, and we can't do this resolution from name to IP address. One other note is that we can cache this information, right? And so this local DNS server is learning a lot of really valuable things, like where's the EDU server? What's the IP address of www.cs.virginia.edu? Rather than having to just look up every single time, it's likely that, you know, if one person in this class accesses the submission server, another person will also do that. And so by caching it here, we can respond much quicker. Yeah?
What if the IP address of cs.virginia.edu changed? That old one was still cached. Would it send you to an invalid link, or how does it not update it?
Yeah, so what happens if you change? There's friction in the system. So you're not going to know that. The DNS server won't know that. The way we handle this is we have a timeout associated with that record. So when we save it here, it's going to keep it for some amount of time before it just forgets it and then looks again in case it did change. So generally speaking, we don't change IP addresses that much using this DNS system because of that. But if you are kind of experimenting with things, you might like not be able to connect to something for a little while until this clears. The alternative is you could just force and go directly to this hierarchy. Because even though typically we delegate this, there's nothing stopping us from running it directly ourselves. So like on your machine, you can go and you can actually do this traversal yourself. It's not a problem. Okay, so that gets us domains, right? And this, by the way, hopefully has kind of made sense that that is a domain, which we use all the time. However, we typically want domains but more information. And that's what a URL is. And so we don't just want to have a single identifier. We want to be able to express more information and in our URL. As an example, we can, you know, we see these kind of all the time, right? So like we have our domain here, but then we can have other information like the destination port. We can have a path, which might map to like a directory structure on that remote server. We can send additional parameters. We can look at a particular point or a spot in the page, and then we also here have a protocol, a scheme that we want to use when accessing that URL. And so HTTP or HTTPS is the most common for the web, but there's others like FTP or a telephone number, you know, or you know, sort of a local path or something else that's implied based on the tool that's being used. We can also have a like a username in here as well. So this is a very flexible structure you know, that we see quite frequently. The primary, I would say probably the majority of the time when we're using URLs is with HTTP. This is kind of what I just said. HTTP is the hypertext transfer protocol. Really, it's the fundamental protocol for the web. And so the unsecure version uses port 80. It's built on top of TCP because we want it to be reliable. When we load a web page, we want to know that the page we're looking at is the correct correct data. There's not sort of missing elements or something like that. And then if we have just HTTP, that's the scheme there. And what's happening kind of behind the scenes for us is that our browser is using these commands to communicate with the web server. So when we load a web page, our browser is doing a GET. It's basically saying, please get this data for me according to this URL. Your web browser takes that data, and then assuming it's well formatted in some known way, can then display it to you. And that's what we're seeing, is the rendered version of something retrieved using HTTP. HTTP is a client-server protocol, meaning that our devices are acting as the client, they communicate with the server, the client makes a request to the server responds. Now in that response, the server also has to indicate a status code, an error of some sort, or success. 200 is what we want to see, that's like everything's great. You may have seen this on the internet, right, 404. That's the HTTP status code for you asked for something and I don't know what that is. I could not find that. Or if something really goes wrong, an internal server errors, code 500. So you may have seen these and it's coming from the protocol HTTP itself. Any questions? Okay, so we were talking earlier about IP and IP addresses, and we have these two different versions of this protocol. Right now, they're pretty much running in parallel. So like all machines support both, which is kind of interesting, but it because every machine has to understand IPv4, or sorry, IP, it's hard to just switch. So we actually run both. But one of the reasons we wanted to switch is because we essentially ran out of IPv4 addresses. Especially like in North America, we allocated them all a number of years ago. So they actually have quite a bit of value, which is kind of interesting. It's just a number, but it's actually worth quite a bit, about $10 or so for an IP address. You know, and back when, it, like 2 to 32 seemed like enough addresses, but it turned out to not be. So how do we deal with this? Well, one option is the IPv6 option, right? Just new protocol, more bits. Now we have more addresses than like atoms in the universe level, and we can't run out, which is nice. But it means everyone has to switch, which is really hard. The alternative is a tool called NAT. Now, NAT is kind of a neat little trick, but what it essentially does is it allows one public IP address, so one IP address that we can actually use on the internet to support many local users. Whether you've known it or not, you use NAT all the time. UVA's network is a NAT. And you can see this because if you go into your computer settings and look up your IP address that your operating system thinks you have, and then you go to Google and you type in, what is my IP address? Those numbers will not be the same when you're here at UVA because of NAT. Now, so this is a really useful tool. And the idea is that we can have one outside publicly visible address, and rather than having to have enough addresses, we can give one to every individual user or every individual device, right? Because we have multiple devices now. We can just share that among a lot of different clients. And that's why you'll get sort of a different address like this inside. So like at home, often we'll have a 192.168 or a 10.0.0 address. UVA likes to use this 172 prefix. But if you ask the internet, like a remote server, what your IP address is, it won't be those because those are only local. So how do we do this? Well, the sneaky bit is there's a sneaky device between our device here and the public internet here that's changing data kind of behind our back, like without us knowing, in a very specific, sneaky way. So if your device here, 1.4, wants to send to the internet, as far as your device is concerned, this is your IP address. So every packet it creates is going to have that as the source address. Now, whatever port you're using, that's going to be there too. Now, of course, if we want to send this from a remote server, we're going to need to use a public, valid, routable address. And we know that. And this came from DNS. Right, and then we have a known port, 443 is HTTPS. However, when that gets to our router, whether that's here at UVA or at home, your router goes, okay, that's great. I can't send this on the internet because that's not public, that's not routable, but my other address, my public address is, I'm going to use that, great. But now all of my local devices would have the same address. And so that's going to get confusing. But we have a port number. And so we're actually going to change the port number on the outgoing side. Again, your software has no idea this is happening. Your operating system doesn't know this is happening. And then this is what's actually going to get sent in the packet that goes out to the internet here. Again, same destination because that we can't change. The remote web server has no idea this has happened. As far as it's concerned, it's talking to this device, which is your router, at that in a service running on that port number, which of course it's not. That's okay. When the external device responds, it's going to send a message back to this address, which is not really the right thing, but it doesn't know that. Your router does, though. So when that comes back here, your router's going to reverse this process. It's going to be able to do a lookup and says, okay, if the response was coming to this port number, the port number I made up, I'm just going to change the destination to this. And so when I actually send it to this device here, it has no idea. So this is how NAT works. It's basically hijacking the port number because we generally don't care what the key here is that this number, 39129, has really no meaning to whatever device is here, you know, whatever server's over here. It doesn't care what port number you use for the source and what port number it's sending back. That doesn't matter. So your router is taking advantage of that, changing it behind your back. Nobody really cares, and then the response comes through. So really kind of sneaky trick. We're really kind of hacking at different layers, right? Because we're changing IP addresses at the network layer, port numbers at the transport layer. Arguably, you don't want equipment messing with your data without you knowing, but hey, it's widely used. It seems to work. We kind of go about our daily lives, and we don't really care that this is happening. Okay, that's basically what I said, and then your router is maintaining a table of these mappings so it can do the lookup. And so as long as you don't wait a really long time to get the response, your router will have this lookup stored and it will do the fix up, and you won't ever know that this is happening. Any NAT questions for now?
So I guess there's a potential of ports across all your machines and more ports inside your network than outside of it. So theoretically you could run out, but there's not that many programs, right? So it'll be fine.
Yeah, so we have what, 2 to the 16 port numbers. So if you had
times the number of machines.
But our outside is one IP address plus the port number. So for it to be unique, we only have 2 to the 16 port numbers that we can uniquely identify to the outside world.
Yeah.
So we get the response, we know what it came from. So we are limited. So like if you want to make more connections from your network at one time than we have port numbers, then NAT will run out. And so at home, I mean, 65,000 connections is a lot, so that's unlikely to happen. Here at UVA, UVA does a NAT, but it does it on multiple public IP addresses. And so it's 2 to the 16 per public IP address.
Yeah. Also, you can reuse the same port number for
different. Ah, okay, right. Yeah, good point. Because we have that 4-tuple, that gives us another more flexibility. So it would have to be 2 to the 16 connecting to the same remote server. Yeah. Okay, so just real quick, the networking lab, just to kind of give you a brief overview, we're going to be experimenting with some of the ideas that we've seen, which is enabling reliable transport, handling acknowledgments. We're going to be sending messages to a simulated server and getting the responses back in increments. And so when we acknowledge, that's going to say, okay, we got that, please send the next thing. And so the general protocol, as you'll see, is we start with a GET, just like similar to HTTP. We're asking for a particular message. The other end is going to essentially acknowledge by actually sending us something, and then as that message, we have to keep sending acknowledgments to keep advancing the message. And we're going to do that with a particular programming style called callback-based programming. So this is the part that you don't write, but essentially it's checking in a while loop if particular events have happened, and if they have, it's going to call a function. What we implement are those functions. right? So you're going to have a receive function and a timer callback. So this is like a timeout. And then you put your logic within those events to implement the protocol. Okay, all right. We'll wrap it up there, and then we'll come back on Tuesday and talk about security in networks. Thanks, everyone.